WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You may think of the middle of the night as a time when everybody's sleeping, but it's a time when millions of Americans have their radios on, listening to Larry King, whose talk show is syndicated to 250 stations through the Mutual Radio Network. King's guests include politicians, show business celebrities, authors, musicians, business leaders. From midnight until 1, King interviews his guests. From 1 until 3, listeners are invited to phone in questions to the guest. From 3 to 5:30, it's an open forum, and he calls that part Open Phone America. For the past couple of weeks, Larry King has been a talk show guest on radio and TV stations around the country. He's been on a tour for his new book, which is called Larry King on Larry King, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. By the way, he's staying in Philadelphia to do his show live from the Franklin Plaza tonight to help celebrate WCIU-AM's 60th birthday. That's the station he's heard on in Philadelphia. Larry King, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. Good to be with you.
Since I know a lot of our listeners are sleeping while you're on, can I ask you to do a little description of your show for our listeners who aren't awake while you're on?
Well, the show airs live midnight to 5 every night, 5:30. We carry over an extra half hour to service some stations. But basically, midnight to 5 is its concept. And in Chicago, it will be heard at 11. In Phoenix, it would be heard at 10. And on the West Coast, the stations on the West Coast have an alternative. They can air it at 9 or begin it at midnight and play back the first 3 hours. We feed it out again to the West Coast. And the format of it is I do an interview for the first hour, a 1 hour one-on-one, or two or three guests if it's a subject. And then at 1 o'clock, we open up the phones for the guest. And from 1 to 3, the guest takes calls with me as the host. And then at 3 o'clock, the guest leaves, and then it becomes Open Phone America. And Open Phone America is really a potpourri of everything. We have no restrictions on the show in that the first person could talk about the Philadelphia Phillies, and the next person could talk about Ronald Reagan. I'm very comfortable with that. It's free flow. We never screen a call. We never ask what the call is going to ask. There's a lot of humor in that portion, a lot of seriousness at times. So it's really two shows in one, the first 3 hours being devoted to the subject and guest, and the remaining 2 hours being devoted to open phones.
In your book, you give your opinions of some of the other interviewers on the air, Cavett, Donahue. How would you describe yourself?
Well, I think I'm an incisive interviewer. I think I'm a natural interviewer and also a street interviewer. By that, I mean, I don't plan an interview. I never think about what I'm going to ask, ever. That's because I started that way, and I'll explain that in a moment. I approach the interview as I approach when I was a kid. I did the same thing. Who are you? Why did you do what you do? Why does this happen? Why? And I have a natural curiosity, which works for me. I'm glib, which also works for me, being born with that trait. And I'm intensely curious about people. All kinds of people. That means I'm curious if the plumber comes to the house to fix plumbing. I'm really curious about why he's a plumber. And that I take that same instance of being curious about why he's a plumber to why Reagan wanted to be president. And when I say street interviewer, the greatest compliment I get a lot is when people say, you ask questions I would have asked, or I don't deal in the sensational. I'm not a devil's advocate. I try to learn as much about the guest. Through me, the audience learns about the guest. And then in the flow of questions that come for the guest, I might intersperse more questions. I think if you do a show that way, at least for me, you acquire an audience that's not only steady and loyal and the like, but also pretty intelligent. Because you got to really be into, you know, except for programs like this, there's rarely any talk show in America does an hour interview anymore. In fact, you don't see it. Well, that's my favorite part, is the interview and the open phones. The 2 hours where I'm taking calls for the guests is really a funnel. And I think an interviewer should, and then I think a show should always do two things. Any talk show, anywhere, if it's on public radio or cable or commercial, if it's on television or radio, it should do both things every day or every night, and that is inform and entertain. You can do an information radio and be dull. You can do entertaining radio and learn nothing. But if you do them both, and that's what I try to do every night, that means I'm going to make you interested, because I'm going to be interested, in the guest. I'm going to draw the guest out. Example, if I'm interviewing a ballet dancer and you don't like ballet, I'm going to hold you listening, because I'm going to ask things you would ask. And you don't have to like ballet at all to ask questions of a ballet dancer. In fact, you don't have to like ballet to be curious about ballet. I don't have to like plumbing to be curious about plumbing. I don't think you can teach it. I don't recommend it. I do a lot of speaking, and I wouldn't say to school kids, don't plan an interview. The reason I'm uncomfortable with it is that I don't want to know anything about the guest. Now, naturally, you have to be well-read. You have to know what's going on in the world. You can't have a guest come on and say Falkland Islands and say, what are you talking about? And then you have to, so I read 4 or 5 newspapers a day. I'm always reading magazines, always reading books. I'm very aware of what's happening in the world. But about the specific guest, Mayor Green is mayor of Philadelphia. He's on my show tonight. I know he was a congressman. He's mayor. That's all I know. I don't know what kind of job he's doing. Now, you could prep me, and that would be fine. It's never been the perfect interview ever done. No one's ever done the perfect interview. So people say, well, if you don't read the book, how can you ask good questions about the book? And that's a dumb question. The reason it's a dumb question is if you don't read the book, you are so curious about that book, it's beyond belief how curious you are. So here's a guy written a book. A guy's written it. If you've read the book, you've lost some curiosity. Now, you may be curious about things in the book. Fine. And I would never tell you don't do that. But from my method, there are times in the career where I have read the book, since I'm reading books all the time. When I have read the book, I don't like the interview at all. I'm not curious about the book. And therefore, I do things I hate to do, like ask questions I know the answer to. I hate to ask a question I know the answer to. I just like to discover things. And since none of us has ever done the perfect interview, yes, if you read a book, you will find out certain things. But I'll find out certain things, too. And I would, since if you have faith in your own ability and you know you're going to listen to answers, sure, we may do, an author may come and do 4 shows. You may be totally prepared. I may be unprepared. And you will touch some things I don't touch. But I'll wager, on the other hand, I'll touch some things you never touch. And I like to also find out as much about the author as about the book. So I might not get to the book for 20 minutes. I might find out who he is and why he wrote this book or why she delved into this topic. But you have to do what pleases you, Johnny Carson told me once. If you don't like the show, if you're the host of the show and you don't like it, the audience will never like it. If you don't enjoy it, the audience will never enjoy it. So I have to like what I'm doing. And that's what I like to do.
I'm aware of your policy of not reading the books and things
like that. Or screening a call. Every talk show screens calls. Well, I don't want a call screened. I want that caller to come on the air, and I want to take that caller. I can dump out on the call anytime I want. Caller's just a part of the show. Caller doesn't own the show. I don't want someone else saying, the 1 on 2 is a good call, the 1 on 3 is an old lady, don't talk to her. The 1 on 4 doesn't sound like they'll make much sense. I don't want that. I'll make that decision.
A couple of things I'd like to know about what happens when you don't read the book. First of all, how can you figure out beforehand what's special about a person? And I don't mean necessarily how to get them to tell the great story that you know in advance is going to be really funny. But like, what makes this particular ballet dancer who you referred to different than every other ballet dancer? How do you know where to reach for that?
I don't book the guests. A production staff books the guests. And they will tell me. Miguel de Guano is on Monday night. Miguel de Guano is a famous Spanish ballet dancer. He came to the United States 10 years ago, and he became an instant hit. He's now in the most demand ballet dancer in America today, and CBS is doing a special on him. Stop. That's all I want to know. Now, don't tell me why he came here from Spain. Don't tell me where he grew up in Spain. Don't tell me his ballet background. That's all I want to know. Then I would go on the air and say, my guest tonight is Domingo Dungo. He's come from Spain 10 years ago. He's a very popular ballet dancer. Domingo, where'd you grow up? Okay, now I could have said, Domingo grew up in Havana. He was born 14. Well, that to me, in fact, another good example of a good show is, when you turn on a good interview show, 9.5 out of 10 times the guest should be talking. If the host is talking, you got a major problem. And hosts talk a lot on interview shows. A lot of hosts interview themselves, which is the world's worst radio. And the guest knows more than I do. So I want to know, sketchy, and of course you could always look at a book jacket, and that's easy to do. But I want to know the least, for example, James Watt, if I've got James Watt on. I don't want him pre-interviewed, and I want to find out how he got interested in the environment. from any standpoint. No, the audience finds out along with me. And that, to me, I'll give you a classic example of this. Let me give you a quick, good example of how it works for me. The other night we were at Disney World and I had Ray Bradbury on. Ray Bradbury is one of my favorite science fiction writers. And except for his current book, I've read everything he's written. And so we discussed with him space and exploration and Buck Rogers and what he was like as a kid and how he got involved in all these things and helping design Spaceship Earth at Epcot down at Disney World. And, you know, in his mind, he's a very live, wonderful guest. We touched on none of his specific books. Callers talked about The Martian Chronicles and Fahrenheit 451. His current book is a collection of poetry. We briefly touched on it. And I asked him, I said, boy, I would guess, for a science fiction writer, I'm going to guess, you would love to go up and out of space. And he said, I've never flown. I said, what? He said, I've never been in an airplane. I don't want to do it. I can write about it, but I don't want to do it. And then I said to him, you're afraid to fly? And he said, no, I'm afraid to fall. which I thought was
nice
very cool. Okay, now, he had been pre-interviewed by a competent pre-interviewer. And the pre-interviewer tells me, Ray Bradbury does not fly. Granted, I could have said, you don't fly. I'm amazed that you don't fly. I really know you don't fly because my staff pre-interviewed you. Tell us why you don't fly. Now, to me, the former was 100 times better radio. Might I not have found it out? Sure. But I ask good questions. I listen, and I ask good questions. So I'm going to get a lot out of you.
What do you do with someone who you have every reason in the world to be good and cynical about, someone who's in politics, or someone who has a lot of power, and whose use of that power is going to affect you and mm-hmm. lots of other people in the United States? And
I ask the best questions I know how. I don't sit down and say, this person has a lot of power,
yeah.
and therefore I'm not antagonistic. That only happened to me once in my life. It was a mistake. The audience didn't learn anything. If you hear an argument, you don't learn anything. Most times in arguments, you just hear points scored. And that happened with George Wallace, and it really ticked me off because he was a segregationist, and I'm very caught up in the race issue and was involved in it a long time. And I let myself get carried away. It was very dynamite radio to hear two people screaming at each other. You didn't learn anything. I ask the best questions I know how. And I don't say to myself, well, this is James Watt, so I better be better with James Watt than I am with the guy last night who's a brain surgeon. My role for me is to find out as much about him as I can. If he has a power base, I'll talk about power. What's it like to have power? A lot of times, you know, in profile kind of interviews, people come off, you know, you really get to... The proudest thing that happens to me is when people say, boy, you know, I really learned a lot about James Watt tonight that I never knew.
Has it ever happened to you that you went back and read something after an interview and realized that the story they told you mm-hmm. and the story that a lot of other people believe to be true are two really different stories?
Yeah. Well, you know.
How do you deal with that?
It's hard because you get lied to. I guess, you know, that's happened to interviewers. And you deal with it as you tried your best. As long as you know you tried your best. It's like, you know, how do you deal with losing a baseball game if you think you're a better team? As long as you tried your best, I tried my best. Now, had I been prepped, yeah, it might have worked in certain cases. And there's certain times, you know, I've done every kind of thing. I've done 15-minute interviews, and I've done locker room interviews. You know, I've been in face with every kind of situation. And we've made a lot of news with the show. But I look at that show as I'm spending 3 hours with this person. We're taking calls, and I'm asking questions. Now, 3 hours is a load of time. Sometimes it doesn't go. The best way I can example of the show not going the way I thought it would go was the recently resigned head of the Veterans Administration. Jack Anderson had really been after him for using private cars and charging the government, and the feeling among many that he was kind of an anti-veteran head of the Veterans Administration. And we did an hour interview, and he was an all right guest, and we discussed those things, and he had the answers. He was billing it back to the government, etc. He resigned 2 days later. I had no inkling that he was going to resign. When we went to the calls, I really thought that this would be a night of, like, Watt had, which was Watt had. You know, it was about 60% favorable and 40% anti, but it was really a wild show. They either loved him or hated him. And I thought this guy would get a lot like that. Every call was, My hospital in Louisville doesn't have an emergency department. Why are my veterans' checks late? Almost to a man, they were all veterans calling in about individual veterans' problems. And the whole tide of the show went that way. He got no call saying, why'd you use a Buick for your own private use? Not one. No one cared. They cared about their own needs. And it taught you something, but it disappointed me.
I find that sometimes I get cynical doing a talk show. I mean, I love doing interviews, but I see the way some people try to use talk radio as a vehicle for self-promotion, and it's something that I feel you always have to be vigilant about.
Yeah, you do. There's nothing wrong with that, by the way. The guest doesn't owe you anything but an appearance and hopefully a response to your questions. And if the guest is there to promote—well, every guest is there. We're always promoting ourselves. Let's be honest about it. Like my friend Herb Cohen says, you can negotiate anything. Everybody is. You want the audience right now listening to you to like you. If not like you, certainly listen. So, the question you ask, hopefully you hope that the lady right now in Society Hill listening to your question likes it. So you're asking it for both yourself and your audience. And I have never had a lot of cynicism. I take the opposite view. I bring a lot of naivety to the program. Street naivety. New York street naivety. Why'd you do that? Why'd this happen? I think of you could be overly cynical. A friend of mine in Miami does a talk show, and he said, I've asked all the questions, and I've heard all the answers. And I said, quit, because I have not asked all the questions, and I have not heard all the answers. I have no idea how this mayor is going to be tonight. I don't know what I'm going to ask him. See, so I don't have. Now, if I go in saying, I'm a little cynical about the mayor tonight, or... three people today told me that he's not a very communicative person. I try to toss that out of my mind because I haven't interviewed him yet. I don't know how communicative he is or not. Someone told me Herb Alpert was the worst guest of all time. I had one of the greatest nights of my life with Herb Alpert.
I heard that. That was really good.
He was kissing me after the show, and the guys were telling me, Herb Alpert, you can't do 20 minutes with Herb Alpert. He's a loner. You know. Well, I think that's it's a skill. It's your job. It's a skill. So I don't have a lot of cynicism. The toughest part to do is, since I'm an interviewer, is when I have a person on whose opinions I disagree with. Since I don't do argumentative interviewing, when I do Open Phone America and I give an opinion on anything, if you call me, you ask me about equal rights, abortion, who I voted for, I tell you. Because it's dumb to do an open phone talk show and not have opinions. So if I have an opinion, I give it to you. You know, I'm not afraid to say that I'm a liberal Democrat, that Hubert Humphrey was one of my favorite people, that Adlai Stevenson forged my interest in politics. I'm not afraid to say that, and I always offer opinions. But my role as an interviewer is a different role. My role as an interviewer to draw people out. And so if I have someone on whose opinions, Falwell was hard that way. Now, I liked Falwell as a person, and I asked him all the questions, and we dug into anti-Semitism and his being anti-black at one time and coming to all those things. And there were certain things, you know, I disagree with him totally on what he says about homosexuals. He might know that I disagree with it, and I'll ask. I think it's an ability to ask a question that is both pruning on the money and the guest likes. I've had that with a lot of religious leaders, and I'm not religious.
How do you deal with, say, not Falwell, but say somebody like him said, you mentioned homosexuality, that, you know, they're very dangerous because they recruit young children all the time, and that's what they do because,
well,
you know,
well, with Falwell
they can't.
I quoted Matlovich. I said, I had Sergeant Matlovich on recently, the homosexual who was thrown out of the Air Force. And he said something to me I didn't have an answer for, but you may have the answer. Reverend Falwell, if a young lady walked in here with a miniskirt, very attractive, would you be attracted to her? And he said, yes. And I said, why? Because Matlovich asked me why, and I don't know why. I mean, I would be, but I don't know why. And then he said to me, if a young man walked in, he would be attracted, and he don't know why. Do we know why? So then, I'm asking Falwells to explain to me why a homosexual is a homosexual. He then establishes by his answer that he doesn't know why either. Well, I have a young daughter. She's in school with male teachers. Should I be concerned about heterosexual advances on her? Now, I never say it antagonistically. Now, the way you lose a Falwell is to say, now, wait a minute. Now, that's the worst. First, he's going to win when you do that. And what you learn from that is that Reverend Falwell, his feelings on homosexuality are based only on what the Bible has told him. Period. He has given it no intense thought. He has never sat down other than to counsel homosexuals about finding the Lord. He has no concept in the world, as none of us do, why we are heterosexual or homosexual. Nobody has the answer to that, and he winds up admitting that. Now, if you're open on the subject, if you're a strong Bible believer, he convinces you. If you're a strong pro-homosexual, you hate him. Now, supposing you're one of these people, and wait a minute, I certainly think homosexuals have the rights, but what about... Now, you hear this, your view should be more clearly honed by my type of approach, and that's the kind of approach that I'm most comfortable with. It's very, you know, nobody can take talent. I can't make you interview like I interview, and you can't make someone else do it. I think there's one thing that all talent has in common, and that's risk-taking. Risk-taking means don't be afraid to ask a stupid question, ever. The question ain't stupid if you don't know the answer to it. If you hear a word mentioned you don't know what it means, ask what it means. If you don't understand an answer, ask them to explain it.
Larry King is my guest for just joining us, the host of the syndicated late-night talk show, and he's also written a book called Larry King on Larry King. I think it's fair to like divide your recent adult life into two parts, before and after your economic, personal finance fiasco in which you were hundreds of thousands of dollars in mm-hmm. debt and were unemployed for a few years. There are a couple of things that you did before that happened, before you were off the air and in debt, that really surprised me, and I wanted to ask you about that. One of them, when you were involved in a lot of finance-type things and were really like making a lot of money but probably losing more than you were making, you said that you needed to get a loan, and you called up a banker, and under the pretense of wanting to research a show on banking, had lunch with him and asked him lots of questions, and then called him 2 weeks later about a loan which he gave you because he liked you after this interview, thinking that you wanted to use his expertise for a program. Would you do that now, something like that, using your status and your visibility as a way to
I come through a lot,
get
you know,
personal things taken care of?
By the way, I also wound up using that stuff in a banking show as well. I never would do that. You know, one of the funny things about writing a book like this, I could have left all that out and written a celebrity book. I could have written a book about all the people I've interviewed, things they've said. I decided once I was going to do this book that I would do an honest book. This is the way I was. This is what happened to me. These are the things I did. We even took out a lot of stuff that we tried to so be honest about it that we took out a lot of stuff that were good about those times. For example, I must have done 5 or 6 charity events a week. I was a soft touch myself. I loaned out a great deal of money. As easy as I took, I gave. I would do a lot of favors for people who did favors for me as best I could. I never combined the two. I never used the radio show. By that, I mean I never said anything on the air. I kept balancing both lines. I decided that I'm going to lay it all out because that's the way it was. The weird part in talking about it, after writing about it, is that I feel like I'm looking at someone else.
Uh-huh.
Because I came through so much since then, and that was so long ago, you know, which is someone at Simon Schuster said, you don't have to put this in at all. It happened in Miami. It never got attention outside of Miami. And it was 1969, 70, 71. That's 11 years. I decided to put it in as a catharsis for myself as well. When you let something out, you know, all the years I've interviewed people, I remember I'd say to the alcoholic, what was it that changed you? And the alcoholics would say, I must have heard this 10 times if I heard of 100. The day I admitted it. Or the drug addict, the day I knew I was a drug addict, the day I knew I had a problem. The best, Dan Bradley, who's a friend of mine from Miami. Dan Bradley is 48 years old. He was head of the Florida Racing Commission. He was head of the OEO in Washington. He's a homosexual. He came out of the closet and told me, best day of my life. It's all gone now. All right. The day I wrote this was the best day of my life. You throw it out. Okay, here's what I did. Here's what I did wrong. Here's some terrible things I did. Now, it's all out there. Now I feel like I'm looking at someone who did that. My life has so materially changed, even since the book came out. I'm raising my daughter. She lives with me. She was in Florida at the time the book came out. She's going to private school now. Bob Wolf, out of Boston, who represents many athletes and show business people, is handling all my funds. I never see a paycheck. He pays all my bills, negotiates all my contracts. I get a living allowance. I got a radio show book out, been asked to write a newspaper column. I've never had anything better. And I never even think about finances anymore. Like, I used to go to racetrack a lot. I was never a classic had a sickness of gambling because I never bet a football game, baseball game, basketball game. I'm a great sports fan, never bet a baseball game in my life. Never knowingly knew a bookmaker. I wouldn't know who to call to place a bet. But I went to the racetrack a lot, and I liked going for the ego. I liked the 10 people at the track, the table, $50 bets, etc. And the other day, someone asked me, when was the last time you were at a racetrack? Now, today I can afford to go and have time to go. And I think the last time was 18 months ago. Just never entered my mind. See, in the old days, if this were 15 years ago, I'd come into Philadelphia, and I'd space things to go to Keystone. But I never think about it.
Getting back to that idea with the bank officer, though, is that something you'd never do now to
never even think of it.
Use your influence to get
something
from somebody?
In fact, we were trying to think of instances, and that was an example.
Yeah.
No, I would never think of it. First, I don't need it. Now, a lot of things that people say is, well, if you're so good, why don't you hand your own money? Why? Why should I even? Well, that's like telling an alcoholic, let's go in and drink three bills. I don't know that I could handle my own money well, but I put a control on myself. I should have done it 20 years ago. But those kind of thoughts never entered my mind because there's no need. Now, if you're dealing with need, then you got a different story. People in need, if you told me your daughter is having a major operation tomorrow and you need $60,000 tomorrow, and I don't have $60,000, boy, I'd try every method I could above board to get it. I'd call the president of the network. But then, if it's 2 o'clock and she's going to die at 3, yeah, sure. So I don't have need. So it's a difficult question to ask. You know, it's like asking the man who is fully hungry, what is it like? Starve. I don't know what it's like to starve.
Something else that you mentioned in the kind of earlier years when you were in Miami that really surprised me. You were doing a show on a station, and a woman called up and propositioned you.
Yeah.
So you put on a Harry Belafonte Live at Carnegie Hall record so that you could go over to her house before your show ended.
That was one of the great moments. That was a funny moment.
I kept saying to myself, what went through his mind when he decided to leave the station and actually go over?
Well, you have to understand. One, let's see. You got to understand Miami. Miami is really... the point I was talking about then is 1958. Miami, circa 1958, was one of the, for a kid in his early 20s out of New York, one of the wildest towns. I mean, what a town that was. Now, I was a kid who grew up in Brooklyn. The Hamish, a Jewish little boy down in no college. Always wanted to get in radio. Now I'm on radio. I'm making $55 a week. As Woody Allen said to me once, I've shared that story with Woody, and he gave me a similar story. Woody Allen canceled a concert engagement once to meet a girl that he adored in high school, who never gave him the right time of day, and who now was calling him and had only 2 hours in Cleveland to spend. And she was going to spend it with him, and he spent it with her. Okay, so I'm this Brooklyn kid. No girl in my life had ever called me, ever. I would try to get dates. I was a nebbishy kind of kid. My only sexual involvement had ever been was this girl I went with from age 18 to 20. She was my only, I didn't know anything, and we broke up, and I went down to Miami, and I was really just, and here I am on the radio. I'm on the radio. And I was doing a morning show. It wasn't my shift. I wasn't on the all-night shift. I was doing a morning show. I was doing sports. I was doing news. I lived at the station 24 hours a day. Almost literally, I had a little place that I stayed in 4 blocks away. I loved it. Loved it. And everything that I ever dreamed of was happening to me. I didn't care that it was $55 a week and that it was a one-lung radio station. And, you know, it went for about 6 miles and stopped. And there I was. And then one night, the all-night guy was sick. And they knew that if anybody missed a shift, they get Larry. Because Larry loves this. Larry's 22. A lot of guys there were like 50-year-old on the way out. And I would do anything. I mean, it was nothing to me. I would offer. I'll do your news. Take along a lunch. And so they said, would you like to do the all-night show one night because the guy's sick? And I said, sure. And I'd worked all day. Time meant nothing to me. The excitement of being on was everything. And I'm on the radio, and there's nobody in the radio station. There were no engineers. And a lady called, and she had a very sexy voice. And she said, I'd never heard you before, and you really turned me on. And I said, well, I get off at 6. And she said, my husband comes home at 6. Could you come over now? Now, I'd never had anybody ever say that to me. And here I am with this unbelievable dilemma. But a woman is actually calling me. I am turning someone on. And I am on the edge. She lives like 11 blocks away. So I put on a long playing record by Harry Belafonte and sped over to her house and got to her house. And she was sitting there by a lamp. I never saw her face clearly, but she looked rather attractive. She had blonde hair, was wearing a negligee. Door was open. I walked in the door. Harry Belafonte was singing. I went over, put my arms around her, and the record got stuck. And I threw her back on the couch and leaped into the car and drove down to the station and corrected the record. Now, that's just the way it happened. Now, in my travels this past week, I have had more radio people tell me that they have had things happen just like that.
You're kidding.
A guy once had a girl come to the radio station. Okay, she came to the station. He had nowhere to go in the radio station but the men's room. And they went in the men's room, and the men's room door got stuck. And the record ended, and he couldn't get out of the door. Those are, you know, if you think that... The thing I guess surprised you most, everyone thinks their life is unique. And I think the more I interview people, and in writing this book, the more I talk to people, everybody has things to degrees they do or would do in a stress situation that they never admit to. And I would tell them now to just admit it, because once you get it off of you, I mean, and everyone's done things of a kind of bizarre nature. Well, I was never a bizarre person. I was bizarre about money and bizarre about handing people money. I've never been drunk in my life, never had an attraction for alcohol. I've seen people do things when they're drunk. Famous people. You wouldn't believe. Wouldn't believe what they would say the next day. What did I do? And I would say to myself, why would someone who has everything get drunk? I didn't understand it. I was a Hamish, a Jewish boy. But conversely, you could say to me, why would someone who has all the potential you have screw up your life, borrowing money? Or say to someone else, why would John Belushi, why would he take cocaine? Why? You know, let's examine that. I understand that. Maybe John Belushi didn't believe. Or I know that, sure, one of my problems was that the boy off the air didn't believe the boy on the air was that good or didn't deserve it. So I understand it more. But it's very easy to go around saying, gee, why did he do that? I mean, why? John Belushi makes $30 million a year. Why do you need that habit? Why do you need that?
You're from Bensonhurst in Brooklyn, and your name was Larry Zeiger before you changed it to Larry King. Did you want to do that yourself, or was it suggested by your station that you change it?
It was suggested 10 minutes before I went on the air the first day. I'd always wanted to get in the radio, and I was hanging around this station, and one guy quit. And on Friday night, they told me, you start Monday morning, 9 o'clock, with your own show, a disc jockey show, and it was 10 to 9. The general manager gave me a little pep talk, and I was nervous. And he said, what name are you going to use? And I had given it no thought at all. I said, Larry Zeiger. And he said, you can't use Zeiger. Zeiger doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's not a showbiz name. And he had the Miami Herald open, and there was an ad in there for King's. I think it was Wholesale Liquors. It could have been Used Autos, one or the other. And he said, how about Larry King? And that minute I had a name and went on the air with it and then legally changed it 2 years later to avoid just confusion. But that's how I got the name. I never thought about it until he told me.
So that's the name on all your legal documents now?
When you legally change a name, I never realized this. I legally changed it in 1959. Do you know they legally change everything? By everything, I mean Social Security, all that. They change your birth certificate. My birth certificate in New York reads, on November 19th, 1933, in the county of Kings in New York City, Jenny Zeiger and Edward Zeiger gave birth to Larry King.
Gee, that's really revisionist, isn't it?
Oh, boy. They wipe out. I mean, name was Zeiger.
Yeah.
It doesn't say Larry Zeiger, a.k.a. Larry King. That's a lot of people in show business don't legally change the name, but leave it a.k.a. By the way, another thing I learned, any name you use is legally yours. You don't have to legally change your name. If you tomorrow wanted to be Joan Jones, you're Joan Jones. And once you sign your name, Joan Jones, you're legally Joan Jones.
Since it's a lot more acceptable now to have ethnic names, would you ever want to change your name back? I understand that it would confuse people a lot.
It would be too confusing. Certainly, if I was starting today, no manager would suggest it. It just wouldn't come up.
Do you think names hold people back anymore?
I don't know. I would hope not. I would, you know, unless the name were hard to pronounce, hard to remember.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think it would hold anybody back. But if you had a name like... Yeah, I would change the name if your name were Terry Rosten Kosten Cashelverts. It would be a source of amusement. It would hurt your career. It would be damaging to you, as much pride as you might have in your name, because, have you watched the Terry Rosten Kosten? But there'd be another general manager who might say, I love it. You'll be known as Terry What's-Her-Name, that kind of thing. But no, that's gone, thankfully. I'm glad that it is the way it is today.
You've been on a book tour, so it's like Larry King guest instead of Larry King interviewer. What are you learning about interviews, getting to be across the mic from every interviewer on radio and
you
TV
really
in the
learn
country?
A lot. I tell you, it's been a... You know, when I used to watch guests come into the show, I like guests on book tours, by the way, because I think I'm a good interviewer, and therefore I think I'm going to ask them things I haven't been asked. And they'd walk in with a glazed look, and I would wonder, why do they look like that? Until you go on a book tour, you don't know. Now, I got to admit, all the wonderful things are taken care of. Simon & Schuster is a terrific publisher. They have great people around the country. When you go to cities like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Miami, they have limos. If not that, they either have sales representatives like the Dohertys here in Philadelphia or escort services. Women in their 40s and 50s who are very successful, and husbands are successful, and they escort authors around. The minute you land at the airport, someone meets you, takes you in the car, takes you to a hotel. The hotel bills are all billed directly to Thomas Cook Travel Agency in New York. Everything is first class. You fly first class. The plane tickets are right up to date. The hotel. So all those amenities, forget it. I mean, you could walk out of your house without one penny and never spend a penny on a book tour. And you never hail a cab. All those things are perfect. Even the spacing of the shows is pretty good. They know that if you've done it two and it takes an hour, and the host in each city knows the city. But, now comes the but. You do, I average 5 shows a day in a city. All right. So far, I've been extraordinarily lucky. I've had some very good shows, like this one, and there was a show in Minneapolis that was excellent. Kelly and Company is a very good show in Detroit, hosted by a husband and wife. Did National Public Radio. But then you get the bad shows. And bad shows are one that have time limits. You're going to be on for 4.5 minutes. You're going to be on with a newsman, news person, who has no idea how to interview and therefore no idea how to ask questions and says to you during the break, I've got 4 minutes. What should I ask you? I mean, that's really bizarre. The zoo shows. There are certain shows that are zoo shows. There's a zoo show in New York called Live at 5. It's very popular. It's the NBC-owned and operated television station. And this show has become an enormous hit, and it has a format. And the format is they do news. They have a news person, a co-news person, a weather person, a sports person. But in between, almost every 3 news stories is a guest. They have 4 different positions around the studio in which guests sit in, and each guest gets 5.5 minutes. Now, this is formatted, 5.5 minutes. Each host says to each guest as they sit down while the commercial's on, boy, do I wish I had more time. You know, they all say the same thing, but they're exactly formatted. That means when you'll get to 5.5 minutes, you off, and on they go to the next, and it's a different person interviewing each different person. And I got the impression, sitting on that show, what she did with me, and she was very, Sue Simmons is a very talented girl, she said, what I'm going to do with you is I'm just going to throw names out, and you tell little stories. And she said, Danny Kaye, Jackie Gleason, Hubert Humphrey. And I says, how many names are you going to throw? And she's like, 6. So I knew that I would do 45 seconds with each name, and it became like a formatted thing. But these kind of shows, you learn nothing. The audience learns nothing. It's an hour blur. There's a lot of television blurs. By that I mean, I know there are anchor people on television who at the end of their show could not tell you any news item they brought you, would not remember what guest was on, have no idea how to ask questions, no interviewing skills at all. They're readers. A lot of readers around the country. So when I see I'm booked on a show like that, I know that's kind of like, all I do then is what I hate to do, is I sell the book. So on Live at 5, where she said, Danny Kaye, I would say, as in my book, or ding, 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 now, or tell a story about the writing of the book. I did that in Cleveland. Guy says to me, what should I ask? I said, I'll give you a funny story about how the book was titled. So he says, okay, and I wound up into a 3.5-minute promotion from the book. But I had an impression on Live at 5. I really feel this because they're so formatted. That if Ted Kennedy were on Live at 5 as one of the zoo, by the way, it's 5 getting no matter who you are. I've been on that show with Bob Hope, I've been on with Christy Hefner. 5.5 minutes. And if you're the zookeeper at the Central Park Zoo, you get 5.5 minutes. Or you're the bongo dancer, or you're Count Basie, 5.5 minutes. And I get the impression that if Ted Kennedy were on, and they're at the 5-minute mark in the interview, and Ted Kennedy says, well, you know, I've been thinking about it, and I've decided that right now, I'm going to tell what really happened to Chappaquiddick. The host would have to say, thank you for being with us. Let's go to the bongo dancer on set 6. And that to me is, that's a non-learning experience. That's television at its worst. That's television trying to be People Magazine. People Magazine does much better. But there's a think or talk radio that's designed where the host has no skills at all. The skills are the host is phone dependent. So you sit down and the host says, my guest tonight is Larry King. He hosts a very popular talk show, and I want to go to calls as soon as possible. Because you know that he has nothing to ask you. And they keep looking at the phones, the phone ringing, how the phone's coming. That's never an indication of how successful a show is, how many phones you get. You could put a psychic on now, and they're going to get phone calls. Don't mean anything.
Larry King is my guest. And for you as a guest, what do you like in an interviewer? What has made you most comfortable?
There's one thing I left out
that I
should have added. That's the toughest part of being a guest is control. Every night of my life for 5 hours, I have control of my environment. I ask what I want to ask. I can let the guest go early. I can keep them longer. Do it before. I mean, you have control of your environment in a talk show. You have control of your environment right now. When you're the guest, you don't have that control. So my inclination is to naturally want to ask you questions. I much prefer asking questions and answering them, and I much prefer hearing people talk about themselves than talking about myself. And what I like in a good interviewer, back to that, is a good eye contact and apparent sincerity about what I'm saying, because you can fake that. A desirability to really want to learn more about me, because that's what a good interviewer does, no matter what tack they take. In other words, I've been on some shows where they only want to talk about finances. I've been on other shows. I did a wonderful show where the guy said, I'm totally uninterested in what happened to you and the ups and downs. I want to talk about interviewing skills. And that was an example of what I gave before. You could be very effective talking as we've talked, touching lots of bases. You can be very effective staying on financial problems. And you can not have to do financial problems and just do, you know, let's take any classic person. So what you want in an interview is to be compelled to talk. If I were doing Reagan tonight, I could do a wonderful hour with Reagan, having nothing to do with politics. That could be a slice of life. No one's going to learn everything. Suppose I did Reagan on movies. Would you turn that off? Suppose I talked to Ronald Reagan tonight and talked about, what films do you order at the White House? Who's your favorite actor? Does Robert De Niro do things you couldn't do? As you look back on movies, how much of skill, we're unable to separate ourselves. See, because now, that's a very good way to interview Ronald Reagan, by the way, no matter what you're doing. And if we do get him on, and we're very close to getting him on, I would spend the first half hour talking about something he spent 60 years of his life doing, because everybody loves to talk about what they did. Absolutely. So I will wager certain things, that Reagan gets Variety every week, that Reagan's aware that E.T. took in $126 million. Got to be aware of it. That's his life, 60 years. I mean, if I became president of the United States, are you going to tell me that I'm not interested anymore in what numbers WTOP radio gets in Washington? Of course I am. This was my life. But there's a twofold reason for that. Not only is it absorbingly interesting to the audience, but you then have them because they're responding to you in the nature of something they love. And then when you do that little bridge, I might bridge with Reagan into using acting ability in politics. And you have a God-given ability, whether you're a great actor or an ordinary actor, you have a God-given that every politician would like to have. I mean, any politician in the world would love to have been a professional actor because that's what the training is. You're trained to do that. Are you aware of it? See, now I don't know the answer. And the fascinating part is I don't want to know the answer because the answer could lead me. Supposing he says, I never think of it. When you watch yourself on tape, Are there little techniques you do that you might say, I've done that before, or I've used that before? Are there days when you go out to make a speech and you're tired, and it's on a subject that doesn't particularly interest you, you're in the farm country and you're supposed to make a farm speech, that you call upon the reserves you used to use on a day you were bored on the set and be the president, acting as the president, as I see. But I've already got them in a comfortability state. We've already talked about film directors and friends who are filmmakers and De Niro and what he thinks of Dustin Hoffman and modern kinds of movies and Steven Spielberg. What do you think of that? Well, to hear a president talking about that. I talked with you, first time I met Hubert Humphrey, I talked about pharmacy. The guy, and then you always learn something. Like, he was vice president of the United States once and went to visit his father and filled prescriptions. I would talk, I'm going to have Jimmy Carter on. I'll talk a little about farming. Guy's a farmer.
With the Reagan thing, when you're asking him about acting skills in politics, you're not putting it in an accusatory mode. Like, come on, you're a real actor. You don't really believe what
never.
You tell the
in
American
fact,
public.
You see, not only is it not accusatory, it's not accusatory in my head because there's nothing wrong with bringing acting skills. I mean, because I know myself, if you made me, I don't like politics, to run in it. If you made me a politician tomorrow and made me president of the United States, and I decided that as president, what I would do once a week, here's something unique I'm going to do as president of the United States. I'm going to do Open Phone America. I'll do it out of the White House. 2 hours every Friday night, call me. I'll talk to you. What would the press print? Hey, that's what he's good at. Of course, that's what I'm good at. That's what I do. In other words, I disagree with Reagan on almost every inch of his politics, but I've never bought the criticism that he's an actor doing politics. He's an actor. We can't take that out of him. It's like saying, you know, well, he's a businessman, and therefore he's negotiating at a business level. He's a businessman. Reagan's an actor. But what that does for you is you get... not only am I absorbed in what he's going to answer, because he's the president of the United States, and everybody's interested in it. You'd be interested in that if it were Nixon talking about movies, what he watched. But this is a guy who must read Variety. You also have them in that you're very interested in what they do. And they're tired of all the hackneyed questions. See, the worst thing you could say to Reagan as the first question is, how the congressional election's going to go? All right, here it comes. We'll gain some, lose some. It's an off-year election, etc. That's the dumbest first question to ask. A good first question is, how you like the job? What don't you like about it? What about being president surprised you?
Do you ever have to act in your position? I'm sure that although you usually get in wonderful people on your show, I'm sure there's been some who've bored you. Do you feel that you shouldn't let on or that
I shouldn't
it's okay?
Let on, no. Uh-huh. I have a responsibility on it. So I had a recent guest that bored me to tears.
Uh-huh.
You also have to respect the fact that you're a professional and you're doing a show. Okay, I had a guest on recently whose expertise was in stereo and hi-fi equipment, and he was maybe one of the top experts in the country on a subject. I have no interest in it. Absolutely zero. The interview went fairly well. I try to understand what FM is, what high fidelity is, what stereo is, what quadraphonic sound is, what you can do in a recording studio. Fine. I really wasn't interested, but I'm working at it. I'm listening. Go to calls. And every call was, I have a 320 tuner. Should I buy the 520 tuner? Well, I almost fell asleep. I was absolutely, totally bored. But I had to keep getting up, you know, and jamming on top of things. That's the hardest. The hardest is when you are turned off by a subject. Very few subjects turn me off. But basically, technical subjects do turn me off. And I try to take them. I've had Nobel Prize-winning chemists on, and I try to discuss them. Chemistry is human. But high-fidelity equipment is a very hard thing to discuss in layman's language.
I've been trying to place your voice. I mean, obviously, it's the voice of Larry King, but is it Joseph Cotton I'm thinking of? Does your voice sound like Joseph Cotton?
Gee, I don't know. You know, no one. I wish, I would hope that's true because he's one of my favorite voices of all time, and he's such a recognizable. I don't think I have a very good voice, but what I have that's been fortunate to me is a very recognizable voice. I don't have great timbre. I certainly don't have a voice like Ken Nordine in Chicago, or Orson Welles, who has one of the great voices ever down the pipes. But I have a voice that's different. and therefore easily recognizable. Someone said, if you're turning down the radio down, you hear me talking, you know that that's me. And I have a lot of New York in it. But Joseph, that's a compliment if you hear Joseph Cotton, because Joseph Cotton would be someone I would list as a voice that's most memorable to me. I mean, you know it's Joseph Cotton.
Right.
But I never think about voice, never took a voice lesson. I just know that I love doing what we're doing right now. I love communicating. I was the kind of kid, and you probably were too, because if you look back on your childhood and you look at age 10 or 11 or 12, you'll see you were doing things that led you toward this path. I was the kind of kid who liked to go to the ball game, come back, and tell everybody about it. Did you see what happened today?
As an interviewer, you've told us that you usually don't read the books of the guests who you have on because you want to be genuinely curious when you meet them. You've been on this book tour for the past couple of weeks, and I'm sure you've had interviewers who've read the books or skimmed the books and who haven't even read the book jacket. Has it made a difference in the way the interviews went?
Yeah. The worst kind of interviewer is the interviewer who tries to lie. By that I mean pretends they read the book. That's the worst. A lot do that. I read your book, and I really want to get at these things. And you notice it in little things. The three things they asked you were all in the book jacket. Don't lie. I never lie. I tell a guest, I haven't read the book. I make a decision a lot on reading the book based on this interview. I do tell guests that. That's a wonderful thing. It's also truthful. A lot of books I read are based on the interview I do with the guest. Sometimes I will have excerpted. For example, I've got Hamilton Jordan's book. He's on tomorrow night. I read the excerpts in the newspaper, in Newsweek, rather, because I read Newsweek every week. And I couldn't just brush by him because I was interviewing him because I was too involved in the subject.
Is there anything that you do that you feel really reinforced in or that you're thinking of changing, having spent the last 2 weeks on the other side of the microphone?
I think in some areas I might like, not that I might use it, but some more information. I'd like to learn more. I maybe like to broaden the interview to an hour and a half and do an hour and a half phone calls because I've learned how much depth means. You know, you really don't know a person in 15 minutes. Maybe I'd like that. And if I do an hour and a half, I'd like to do longer form. I like the longer the better. I was very lucky. The first 8 years I did radio and television, I never took a phone call. I would do a four-hour show every night with 3-4 guests, no phone calls. Like we have taken no phone calls. This, to me, has been a learning kind of radio experience. See, I would assume that this is excellent radio. The host knows better than I. Host always knows better than a guest. But a host feels pace. A host feels timing. A host feels responsiveness. But that's the best kind because the audience now is listening in to two people talk. And that's magic. And radio does that especially well. So that's one thing I've learned. Another thing is that as a guest you learn blank eyes. Uncomfortable interviewers are very hard on a guest. The person who not just doesn't know how to fake it or fake it well or can't transmit the fact, you know, that I read the book and didn't read the book, but the person that has no concept of what you're doing, where you get the impression that you could say anything. I had a girl in a city that I had the impression, she said, how'd you break into the business? That I could have answered by saying, my family and I were in Hiroshima, and when the bomb dropped, my father, as he flew up in the air to his demise, said, go into radio, that she wouldn't have heard that answer. Bob and Ray used to do a takeoff on The Bad Interviewer. Wally Ballou was their guy, and he's in the street, and they bill him as the world's greatest interviewer. And he's on the street, and a man comes along, and he says, what's your name? The guy says, John Smith. He says, where do you live? Bayshore, Long Island. What do you do for a living? I'm a KGB agent. Are you married? Of course, the whole key, when you get right down to it, there's one word, it's key is listening.
Thanks for talking with us. Larry King's been my guest, and he's got a new book called Larry King.